Millennials will soon oust baby boomers as the largest voting bloc. What might that mean? It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also, in this hour of quick conversations, Joyce Russell with some highlights from a busy week at the Iowa legislature, Amy Mayer on how animal confinements are connected to water quality in the state, an especially disturbing case of several hundred animals rescued from a Vinton residence, a University of Iowa lawsuit that pits gay rights against religious freedom, and should Iowa kids be required to learn patriotism in school? Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, an especially disturbing case of several hundred animals rescued from a Vinton residence. We'll hear the details of that. Also, a University of Iowa lawsuit that pits religious freedom against gay rights. Also, should Iowa kids be required to learn patriotism or something called Americanism in school? We'll talk about that later in the program. But first, it's the second week of the 2018 session of the Iowa legislature. Let's check in with Joyce Russell, IPR State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Let's talk about a couple of things here. Let's start off with the DHS director's comments. Jerry Foxhoven, director of the Iowa Department of Human Services, apologizing this week. What is he apologizing for?
Well, as you know, the state has a new family planning program that takes the place of Planned Parenthood clinics around the state because Planned Parenthood provides abortions. And it's really kind of starting from scratch on this, putting together a list of providers for people to go to if they can't go to Planned Parenthood for subsidized services. And there have been some problems rolling that out, coming up with a good clean list of providers. And he said that they could have done a better job on that. They're working on cleaning up that list. They have a list of providers that people on there that don't, like dentists who don't provide family planning services, so they're working on cleaning up that list.
Yeah, I was reading. He's also trying to change the culture there. I think his quote, he says he's directing a bureaucracy beyond bureaucracy at the DHS, so he's tackling that. Let's talk about a proposal there at the legislature, I understand, to lessen the penalties for small amounts of cannabis. Where is that? How did that come about? Because we have a GOP controlled House and Senate, right?
That's right. And this is a proposal that's been out there for a while. This is an extremely about as limited as you can get to roll back penalties for marijuana. This is for first-time only possession of very small amounts, 5 grams or less. And this has been out there for a couple of years. It actually passed the Democratic-controlled Senate and then didn't go anywhere in the Republican-controlled House. But Senator Brad Zahn is kind of taking this on. He has young children. He has probably teenagers. He said, I'm not commenting on whether they've gotten in trouble, but he has this sympathy for young people who get stuck with a marijuana charge, and then that haunts them for the rest of their lives. So this lesser penalties, it'll be a simple misdemeanor instead of a serious misdemeanor. Backers say that this means that it's actually less likely that you would be jailed for any length of time. And Senator Zahn says you can get that stricken from your record. And so there is Republican support for it. It cleared the full Judiciary Committee last year. Senator Dix did not see fit to bring that to the full floor. And so it's probably going to go through Judiciary again, but it'll be up to Senator Dix to say whether it goes any further.
Joyce, in just a minute, I'm going to talk with our colleague Amy Mayer, our ag reporter, about how animal confinements are connected to water quality in the state. Tell us, because this is prompted by a protest at the Capitol this week, the Iowa Alliance for Responsible Agriculture, calling for a moratorium on CAFOs. These are animal confinements where mostly out of sight here, where just an incredible number of animals are raised. What happened this week in this area?
Well, they had their annual lobby day at the Capitol, had a good turnout, brought people up to the microphone to talk about the dangers of these CAFOs, the tremendous growth that there has been. They're backing a bill to have a moratorium on these CAFOs until only 100 Iowa waterways are impaired instead of the many more than that that are impaired. There is virtually no chance that this will advance in the Republican-controlled legislature. It has been assigned to Senator Ken Rosenblum, a Republican in the Iowa Senate who has been very skeptical in the past about even the need to address water quality. He said, I'm not sure what they're trying to correct here with this moratorium, but I'm trying to grow Iowa and not hurt Iowa. And I think that probably tells you the likely fate of that bill.
Okay, Joyce Russell, thanks for giving us a few highlights from this very busy week at the legislature. Joyce, I look forward to working with you on Monday on this program. We'll be focusing on water quality in the state. The House and Senate have side-by-side have water quality bills. I guess we'll compare those with some lawmakers. So I look forward to that, Joyce.
Okay, that's the plan.
Okay, thanks. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we heard in our news this week that a coalition of about two dozen state, local, and national groups, they say that Iowa lawmakers should halt construction on animal confinements until Iowa's water quality is significantly improved. This is the Iowa Alliance for Responsible Agriculture asking lawmakers to support 15 bills tightening the oversight of confinements, bills introduced by Senator David Johnson. That's an independent senator from Ochiden. Let's get a better picture of what are called CAFOs. What we call CAFOs stands for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations in our state. Amy Mayer is with me, Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media reporter. Hi, Amy.
Hi there, Ben.
So remind us, CAFOs, how many of them are there? Because actually driving through the countryside, if you're not looking for them, you might miss them, right?
In some areas, you can go past and not even realize it. Confined or concentrated animal feeding operations are housing for animals that have a full roof. And so the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has estimated there may be about 13,000 in Iowa, and these could be of any of a number of sizes. They might have hogs, they could have turkeys or laying hens, and typically in the bills that we're talking about, we're looking at hog barns, but the term can be used for any kind of livestock.
Mm-hmm. And you've visited a CAFO. What was it like?
Oh, I've actually been in several hog barns, in fact, that would qualify under this definition as a CAFO.
When you say barn, it's not an old red barn. These are huge warehouses, right?
The farmers would call them barns, okay. And the opponents would call them warehouses, yes.
Okay.
So some of the ones that I have been in would be they're wide and long, and yeah, they don't have big barn doors like you associate with driving a tractor through. They usually have a normal size door that a human walks in. In the case of hog barns, there's often an entry area where there's a shower, and the workers would have to shower in to get into the hogs and on the way out shower again. But generally, we're talking about a large building that has a walkway down the middle. It's divided into smaller areas as you walk through. So there'll be groups of hogs, which are pretty social animals, together in certain spaces. And they'll have feed that gets sent in from usually an outside feed silo. The feed comes in on some kind of conveyor, and it's brought to centralized areas in those sort of sections, and the hogs all have free access to that when there's food, and then there's usually water pumped in and available to the hogs at different watering locations.
Okay, so you're fattening these hogs as quickly as possible, getting them ready for market, not only in Iowa, but a lot of Iowa hogs are exported to the world. So let's talk about the impact. Of course, you just named the inputs. There are some outputs, right, that are problematic.
Right, and one of the things that the DNR's regulations are intended to help with is managing the manure. The kinds of barns that I just described usually have a slatted floor, and they're built over a pit so that the waste goes down the slats in between loads of pigs, you know, when a group of pigs reaches market size and they leave, that entire barn would be washed down. So all of that, the cleaning process would also fall into those slats. And then those, they're sometimes called lagoons underneath, which contain the manure slurry. Those are eventually pumped out and used as fertilizer on surrounding crop fields.
Mm-hmm. So back to the headline here, the news of this week, I should say, halt construction on animal confinements, CAFOs, until Iowa's water quality is significantly improved. We do know Iowa's water quality, our lakes, our streams, not good. Also compared to the nation, not good. Both parties have said, We've got to improve this. So what is the connection? Is that a legitimate sort of connection to make, that all these CAFOs, the proliferation of them, is not improving, perhaps hurting our water quality?
I think there's two things to consider in this. On the one hand, all that manure does have to go somewhere, and that manure does contain nutrients. Farmers want that manure on their fields because they want the nutrients on their fields. It means they then don't have to use some kind of synthetic fertilizer. At the same time, it is the application of any kind of fertilizer on farm fields that can result in nutrient runoff. For example, if it's applied and then there's a storm, that the nutrients won't be taken up by plants and instead they'll get washed away. So that's a part of it. At the same time, I think trying to put all of the focus on animal agriculture runs the risk of diminishing the significant impact that cropland agriculture, row crops, has on our water quality as well. Because again, if synthetic fertilizer is applied, it can also cause nutrient runoff. So I think there's a little bit of activist indignation trying to kind of put something all together when maybe it's a broader thing than they're defining it as.
Right. So farmers, advocates of what is presently going on in these CAFOs, they counter it saying, hey, it could be worse. We're using manure. What do you know, we're reusing, we're recycling what is a waste.
Right. And the other piece of that is they are containing it when it's being when the hogs are living and they're defecating, that's all being contained, and then they can later take that and put it someplace deliberately, which they like to put out there as a more manageable process. And in fact, when a CAFO is going up for DNR approval, if it has a certain number of animals, then the farm would have to provide a nutrient or a manure management plan, and that's a whole other piece of animal agriculture in Iowa, is these manure management plans and companies.
Okay, thanks for giving us a picture. Sorry, over the lunchtime of the way we raise our animals and the waste products they have. Amy, before we go, is it true more hogs than people in Iowa?
Yes, significantly more, like about 7 to 1.
7 to 1. There are 3 million people in Iowa.
Yeah, there's about 22 million hogs.
Oh, my. Okay. I'll drive through the countryside in a different way.
Enjoy your bacon.
Amy Mayer, Iowa Public Radio, Harvest Public Media reporter. Thanks, Amy.
You're welcome.
Finishing up this Friday with a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. You know, millennials, I don't know if you know what generation you're in. Are you a millennial? Are you a baby boomer? Are you Gen Y? Well, millennials will soon oust boomers, baby boomers, as the largest voting bloc. What might that mean? Dave Anderson joins me from Ames to explain that to us, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, and of course one of our regular skilled political analysts. Dave, welcome again. I think 2 times this week.
Nice to have you.
This is a record.
Okay, so let's make sure we know what we're talking about. Millennials. This is the generation they were born starting sort of in the early 80s until perhaps the early 2000s. They come after there's Gen X, which is 1965 to 1984. But the boomers we're talking about in the 50s, early 50s to almost the mid 60s. So that's how we define those generations for whatever reason. Why is this important to point out that millennials will oust boomers as the largest voting bloc?
Well, usually in the country, since we're a democracy, our political issues and our political conversations are center around the things that people care about. And the things that people care about change generation to generation. And since 1980, the baby boomers have been the dominant voting generation in America. And they have defined what we talk about. It was really in 1980 when we started talking about taxes as an important issue, and gun control and abortion. And for 40 years, those have been the things that we focused on with both parties. And the millennial generation is probably going to finally shift us to new issues.
Mm-hmm. So they care about different political issues than the boomers do.
Yes, they care about different things, and they care about things in different ways. So a lot of the conversation right now is about how the millennial generation aligns with the current issues we talk about. Mm-hmm. And we can see that they're different. But the big question is, what are the new issues that they are going to put on the table that will redefine the next 20 to 30 years of American politics?
Mm-hmm. Do you have any partial, at least, answer to that question you posed?
Well, I think they are going to shift the focus of how we talk about government. We've talked about liberalism and conservatism, as in liberalism is big government, more taxes, and conservatism is lower taxes, less government. And millennials seem to want lower taxes, more government. They are really in favor of smart government that is more efficient, and we haven't really talked about that yet as a country.
What about on the social side? How do millennials compare to boomers when we talk about conservative versus liberal there?
On the social side, they are much more liberal. They are much more welcoming towards homosexuality, towards immigrant communities, and in that way, the Republican millennials act a lot different than boomer Republicans. They mm-hmm. they agree on the partisanship, but on the social values, they're very different.
And again, of course, people listening will say, hey, but I know this young person who is very socially conservative. We're talking in broad generalizations, right?
Yes, there is no single definition of what a generation thinks. Of course, it has an entire spectrum with it. We can just see big shifts in the averages.
Mm-hmm. So I have to believe your party strategists are paying attention to this, as you are as a political scientist. Will the parties be reacting to this? Will they be proactive in searching out this largest voting bloc of the future?
Yes. And I think the Democratic Party got off to the better start. Obama attracted millennials originally, and then in the 2016 election, it was Bernie Sanders who caught most of the millennial attention. Millennials really liked Bernie Sanders and the way he talked about the possibilities of government. Of course, when he lost the nomination, a lot of millennials turned against the Democratic Party. They saw the party as a corrupt institution that was against their interests. But the Republican Party really didn't do much to court millennials, at least in terms of the issues they're focusing on. Lately, the Republican Congress has done – well, actually, the Trump administration moved to ban net neutrality. And for other generations, the internet is kind of a tool. I think boomers view the internet largely as a tool. Gen Xers probably see it more as an entertainment device and a tool. But millennials see the internet as – a part of the environment. It's like air and water, and they view an attack on net neutrality as direly as they view pollution.
Mm. You mentioned the attitude toward government a moment ago. Talk a little bit more about millennials compared to boomers and how they view government. I mean, boomers, when we think back at the generation when they became adults of voting age, they would have been right in the thick of the Vietnam War, the civil rights era, the Watergate era, right?
Yeah. Boomers grew up really enjoying the fruits and benefits of the growing New Deal government apparatus. They benefited from massive investments in education and infrastructure, and it created the American middle class as the way we know it. But then when boomers became a voting population, they decided they didn't want to pay for it anymore. So we started cutting taxes that supported these ideals. And now we're 40 years later trying to figure out where we're going to go. And millennials are unique in that they have grown up from their youngest age being told you will never enjoy the fruit of our largest government programs. Medicare will not be there for the millennials. Social Security will not be there for the millennials. So they kind of interestingly align with a lot of Republicans in saying, well, let's smash the system that's there because millennials know they're not going to benefit from it anyway. But at the same time, they're much more open to putting something in place. The repeal and replace of government writ large, I think, is a millennial value right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I've talked to millennials about this, and I'm sure you have too, Dave. There is an anger there that what the boomer generation is enjoying currently as it kind of tails off into a retirement in the coming years will not be there in the same way for millennials, and millennials are paying into the same system currently.
Yes. I've talked to both millennials and a lot of boomers about this. And my one thing that I keep saying to boomers is you've got to watch out because the millennials are coming and they're coming for you. Because a lot of millennials have this sense that previous generations have always invested in the next generation. And we stopped doing that somewhere 10, 20, 30 years ago. And the current generation has been raised being told you will not enjoy the same kind of lifestyle as your parents. You are going to have greater challenges. You won't have the kind of incomes of previous generations. You're going to have to work harder. There's going to be no social safety net. And they are angry about this. And they are still waiting for a political candidate to talk to them in a way that really galvanizes them together.
I think your explanation really shed some light on the 2016 campaign, the primary campaign between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. I mean, that's sort of the root of it, wasn't it, in a lot of ways?
Absolutely. If you look at what Clinton and Sanders believed in, what policies they supported, they were very similar. The big difference was that Bernie was angry about it. Clinton campaigned on a very rational, incremental approach to smart policies. And Bernie would get on stage and scream and shout. And he was so angry at the injustice of it all. And for millions of millennials, they sat back and said, yes, you get us. You get our frustration that we feel every day and nobody's talking to us.
Mm. And so even though Bernie was far from being a millennial, he was tapping into it in a big way.
He was. Ironically, I think the two politicians in America who resonate the most with the millennial generation are both in their 70s, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
All right. Hey, we've got a couple minutes left. Let's talk about this. Let me see. We're maybe you've got a countdown clock on your desk or in the studio there. The government will shut down at 12:01 a.m. Saturday, which is, you know, less than 12 hours from right now. That's if lawmakers fail to get an agreement on some kind of spending bill. Have you been keeping your eye on that today?
I have a bit. It's difficult to keep an eye on because Congress is in this behind-closed-doors session that they've kind of been operating on for years now. And we hear rumors about the president is now talking to, I believe, Chuck Schumer about brokering a deal. But any deal that he brokers with the Senate Democrats, they're going to need the House to also vote on something. And the House is getting out of session and won't be in session for another week.
Right.
It's going to be an exciting day.
Okay. The Democrats sort of ready to block a deal, gambling that the president will offer concessions. And that's why Schumer is at the White House reportedly there, huh?
Yes, it seems like Democrats have finally kind of gotten fed up with Republicans blocking what they have promised to do. This is all centering around DACA right now. And the idea that when President Trump decided to remove DACA, he even said, we need to have a legislative solution. And Republicans and Democrats in both chambers all agreed, yes, we need a solution. And here we are 3 months later after many promises to actually enact something, and there's still nothing done.
Right. And here we are, what, about 5 years after the last government shutdown? I'm sure you remember that, Dave, in 2013, that time over the Affordable Care Act.
Yes. And it ironically is coming back to the minority party refusing to work with the majority party. And it seems like it's the people of the United States who get caught in the middle.
All right. Dave Anderson, we are glad you are in the studio giving us analysis, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University in Ames. Dave, thanks for stepping in. Get out and enjoy the sunshine. I hope everybody does.
I'm leaving right now.
All right. Well, when we continue after a short break, we'll continue with this NewsBuzz edition of River to River. We'll talk about an especially disturbing case of several hundred animals rescued from a Vinton residence and what you should do if you suspect animal abuse, mistreatment in your neighborhood. Also, a University of Iowa lawsuit that pits gay rights against religious freedom. All coming up in our second half hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Welcome back. We're midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of our program. Half dozen conversations about some news that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows. Coming up in just a few minutes, a University of Iowa lawsuit that pits gay rights against religious freedom. Also, another story, we'll talk with Bill Petrosky of the Des Moines Register about whether Iowa kids should be required to learn patriotism in school and what that might mean. But first, this week, animal rescue organizations rushed to offer assistance in what appears to be a massive animal hoarding situation. Joined now by Preston Moore. He's Director of Development and Community Outreach at the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Hello, Preston.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
We had originally were set to talk with your executive director at the Cedar Valley Humane Society, Lonnie Viner, but she was called away. Is this another issue of animal hoarding, or what's happened? Do we know?
Yes. You know, unfortunately, there's never a dull moment around here, and we got a call this morning to help with 20 dogs that were in kind of some bad conditions, and I can't go into too many details right now, but we are doing exactly what we're here to do, and we opened our doors for 20 dogs. She's in the middle of that rescue right now.
Okay, well, thank you for stepping in for Lonnie. We hope that goes well with those animals. Let's go back earlier in the week. I think this is Tuesday, the Vinton Police Department investigating it. Describe what was found at the Vinton residence.
We got a call early on Tuesday to head to Vinton to assist with what we were told was several hundred animals in a home. And we got there, and several hundred quickly became, you know, probably closer to 1,000 animals, guinea pigs, rabbits, rodents of all sorts, some reptiles, birds, chinchillas, you know, several exotic types of animals, all packed into one room, primarily in the basement, and then there were some enclosures on the first floor of the home as well.
Wow.
But 8 hours later, we and some of our rescue partners removed all of the animals from that home and have begun the process of getting them medical evaluations and medical care.
So describe some of the conditions. I understand there were dead animals, decaying animals among the living, right?
That's correct. Yes, there were some enclosures where there were living rabbits and guinea pigs alongside animals that had been dead, not for just a couple of days, but probably a number of weeks based on the decay levels. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of cages, floor to ceiling, every wall, every counter space, every table was full with animals. You know, we would pull the washer and dryer away from the wall, and there were more animals, both living and deceased, behind there. Almost every square inch of the basement was filled with an animal.
Oh, my gosh. I don't think it's anything. I mean, you cover these things. You're sent out to help in these situations. I imagine you never get used to something like this.
Absolutely not. This isn't something you can get used to. You know, when we got a call saying there were several hundred animals, we sort of prepared for the worst-case scenario. We loaded up every kennel that we had, every enclosure, every tank into our vehicles and headed that way. But, you know, by expecting the worst, we really weren't even prepared. It was even worse than that.
Mm-hmm. Is that an emotional experience for those who go out?
Yes. You know, I was there helping unload these animals from that home. And in the moment, you know, your first reaction is to be upset and emotional because you do care about these animals. And you care for the people that are there that have, I guess, hoarded these animals as well, because something clearly isn't happening correctly in their lives. You know, you feel for these people and for the animals, and you don't really take it all in emotionally until later that day, because your first priority is to get all the animals out of the home and into a shelter environment where we can get them medical care.
Mm-hmm.
But in the days since, definitely, you know, you can see on all of our staff's faces and our volunteers' faces, this is hard. These animals have not had proper food and water or medical care for a very long time.
Mm.
And most of them have a variety of medical ailments that we're treating. It's tough, absolutely.
Yeah. Explain to us as much as you can of how you understand the thinking of someone who hoards animals like this.
I am not sure in the specific case why this person had so many animals. I do know that she has said publicly that many of them were show animals for her children, for 4-H and for different competitions. But there is no feasible way a handful of people could show and exhibit literal thousands of animals. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. We've received a number of tips from people that have seen this family selling animals, both online and at flea market type events. So I can only sort of speculate, but I'd imagine these animals were for sale. Yeah. We do know that she had requested the city of Vinton to give her permission to sell snakes in city limits, and that was denied. We do know she did not have licensing through the state to operate as any sort of a pet retailer. So I'm not sure how it got so bad so quickly, but we just don't know how it got this bad.
Right. I don't know if the name has been made public of this woman, the people who live at this house. I don't know if you know, will charges be filed? Who is it, if we know publicly yet?
The woman's name is out there publicly. Her name is Babs Galkowski. We do not know if there are charges being filed right now. And that's not really our place as the Humane Society to do that. But what I can say is that we're cooperating very fully with the Vinton Police Department and any other agencies that have reached out to provide all the information, all of the vet evaluation paperwork, photos and that sort of thing, so that they can pursue charges if that's something that they decide to do. It's difficult in Iowa because of the way that our animal welfare laws are set up. This state, and rightfully so, is set up to protect our agriculture businesses. But I think any reasonable person could look and see a very distinct difference between a commercial hog lot and having 1,000 guinea pigs and rabbits in a basement.
Mm-hmm. For those who may run across something, I mean, this was called attention to by neighbors, I understand. The search warrant was gained. You mentioned a few of the neighbors there. When should you act? When should you call the Humane Society or the police?
We always recommend that people do call the police or county sheriff departments, depending on where they live. The process for getting animals removed like this always starts with law enforcement. And so if somebody is concerned about something they see with animals, we always, always recommend that they reach out to law enforcement in their area. And typically law enforcement partners with an agency like ours for animal removal and animal sheltering. And so that's really the route that people do need to take.
Just to mention here that the Cedar Valley Humane Society is accepting donations to assist with the care of these animals, right? How can people get in touch?
Absolutely. People can donate if they'd wish on our website at cvhumane.org, or they can find our address and, of course, mail contributions or items that way. They can also drop them off in person.
Okay. Preston Moore, Director of Development and Community Outreach at the Cedar Valley Humane Society, will let you get back to it and join Lonnie Viner, your executive director there. As we heard at the start of this conversation, more than 20 rescue dogs that you're racing to attend to now. Thank you, Preston.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our week before we head into the weekend. Well, let's look at an interesting legal battle. It's brewing at the University of Iowa, one that pits gay rights against religious freedom. Joining us now from Des Moines, Katarina Sestarek, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us, who filed the lawsuit and why?
Business Leaders in Christ filed the lawsuit. They were a student group at the University of Iowa. And so what happened with them is they had a member who was seeking a leadership position within the organization. That member came out as gay, and they denied a leadership position to that student. The student then complained to the university about it, and the University of Iowa deregistered the student organization. The university says they found that the group violated the university's human rights policy and the Iowa Civil Rights Act, and that the university doesn't tolerate discrimination of any kind. After that, the group, also known as Blink, sued in federal court. They're saying that they were discriminated against for their religious beliefs regarding sexual behavior, sexual orientation. And so now that is a battle in federal court.
Mm. Oh, interesting. So this is a case where the business leaders in Christ, this group Blink, as they go by, they say by having a gay student in a leadership position, that violates the beliefs of the group. But we have the local and state laws pitted against that. So it's interesting here in reading about this, Katarina, tell us about who's representing Blink in court and a little bit about their background.
Right. So the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty is providing lawyers for Blink. And so they're based in Washington, D.C. They're famous for successfully defending Hobby Lobby in the U.S. Supreme Court. That was a case where the owners of Hobby Lobby refused to provide contraceptive coverage to female employees based on the owner's religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Somewhat similar to the Masterpiece Cake case before the U.S. Supreme Court. The question there, whether a Christian baker in Colorado, I believe, should be allowed to refuse to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. I understand there was a hearing yesterday. What happened there?
Yes. Blink was asking to be reinstated as a student organization while the lawsuit plays out. They're kind of saying that they'll be irreparably harmed because one of the things that if they're deregistered as a student organization, they can't participate in the student activities fair where different student groups try to recruit students each semester. And so that's going to be next week. And they are arguing that they should be reinstated before that fair so that they can have a fair shot at recruiting fellow students to join their group. So there was an argument over that in federal court yesterday.
So in this lawsuit, are there any other inputs that might influence the judge here, Stephanie Rose of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa?
Yes, so five other student organizations have filed a brief as friends of the court. They're on the side of Blink. There's four Christian student organizations and one Jewish student organization, and they are interested in how this case will play out because they're worried that maybe their leadership decisions will be affected in the future. They say that they want to ensure that they can pick leaders whose beliefs are similar to theirs, that follow their own beliefs. And their lawyers are coming from the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a conservative Christian nonprofit, and some call them an anti-LGBT hate group. They've been involved in a lot of different transgender and gay rights cases across the country, so that's another interesting legal point in this case.
Okay, you'll be following the story, Katarina?
Yes.
All right, very good. Thanks for letting us check in with you, Katarina Sestarek, looking at an interesting legal battle shaping up at the University of Iowa, pitting gay rights against religious freedom. Here's a note, too. I'm reading here, too, that the student in question who was rejected for this leadership position, just as a footnote before we go away, Marcus Miller is his name. He has started his own university-recognized organization called Love Works, a Jesus-centered student group that advocates for LGBTQ justice. All right, there. We have an update on it. Thanks, Katarina.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally, today, a state government panel representing Iowa's military veterans said this week that more emphasis on, quote, Americanism and patriotism should be required for Iowa students attending K through 12 schools. Well, let's check in with Bill Petrosky, senior reporter at the Des Moines Register. He's been covering state government in Iowa for quite a long time, since the early 1980s. Hi, Bill.
How are you doing, Ben?
Great. This is part of a policy agenda, I understand, from your reporting. The Iowa Veterans Commission has this on their agenda for the 2018 session of the legislature. You spoke with its chairman, Dan Gannon of Ankeny. He's been on our program many times. What a fine man, Marine Corps infantry veteran. So what are they putting forth here?
What they're specifically saying is we request that the Iowa legislature enact legislation that would instill Americanism and patriotism in grades K through 12. And, you know, just exactly what that means, obviously, that's very subjective. But the thing is that I think what they're saying is, hey, they're hearing anecdotally and they have a lot of these folks are older veterans. They see the younger generation, and they've heard that some schools might not be doing the Pledge of Allegiance and might not be paying a lot of attention to things that have been traditionally taught in Iowa schools about patriotism and civic engagement and that type of thing. And they have a concern that that's not happening. And they kind of want to send a message that, hey, we want a focus on this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. So not necessarily a bill, just awareness?
Well, what they're saying is they actually would like legislation. Now, the issue here is do you want to do an unfunded mandate on schools? That was a response that I got from State Senator Jeff Edler of State Senator. He's vice chairman of the Senate Education Committee. He said, he's sympathetic with this. They don't want to do an unfunded mandate, but they want to recognize the importance of individual students understanding their roles as citizens in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Back to this idea that you mentioned too, and the crux of this too is what is patriotism? That can be debated, right?
Absolutely. And I talk with Des Moines Public Schools. Des Moines Public Schools is by far, I think, twice the size of any school district in the state. 33,000 students. They've got kids from all over the globe. There are dozens of languages, many, many immigrants, many, many minorities. It's about as diverse a place as you can. And I asked the Des Moines School District, I said, are you folks doing something about patriotism and Americanism in your schools? And they said, actually, a heck of a lot. If you go to Des Moines Public Schools, there are two ROC units, ROTC units at North and Central Campus. They're dressed, the kids dress up in military uniforms, and I've seen them here at patriotic ceremonies, Veterans Day ceremonies, Memorial Day ceremonies, that type of thing here. Each day starts with the Pledge of Allegiance at elementary and middle schools here. In Des Moines, they sing the national anthem before athletic events. The flag is displayed in classrooms in front of each school building and in school classrooms. They do a range of activities marking U.S. history and talking about American leaders. They have mock elections and debates in schools and that type of thing. They have talk about Black Lives Matter, many different things. They have really underscore civic engagement a lot, as well as having, a full social studies curriculum from kindergarten through graduation. Now, talking with individual legislators, what they've told me is, hey, it's their impression that this really kind of varies from school district to school district, and they would still like to underscore this. And I talked with the State Department of Education, what they've said, there are currently no state requirements specifically requiring that patriotism and Americanism be taught in Iowa schools, nor are there any requirements that students recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, this kind of takes off a little bit on an important thing that was discussed by the Adjutant General of the Iowa National Guard in a speech last week. Major General Tim Orr, he expressed concern that a large percentage of U.S. military members are coming from the same military families, and I think that's kind of what this is about. If you've talked with people in the military, they're aware that there are a lot of people who support the troops, but they feel that a lot of families out there really don't recognize the burden that they have and don't have the feeling about patriotism and Americanism that perhaps some people have done in the past. And what General Orr mentioned was that since the draft ended in 1973, more than 80% of U.S. service members are coming from families where at least one parent, grandparent, aunt or uncle, sibling or cousin has served, and more than 25% of the troops have at least one parent who served.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see some of the comments on the Des Moines Register Facebook page in reaction to this article. Mason Meyer, for instance, to read one, there's a difference between teaching civics and citizenship and teaching, quote, Americanism. It's high time we quit indoctrinating students to think we are the absolute best country at everything. We know that simply that just simply isn't true. Mason Meyer's words on the Des Moines Register Facebook page, a lot of other discussion going on there. You can define patriotism in many different ways, obviously, Bill, as you've just outlined. The veterans throughout Iowa filled the Capitol, the rotunda there on Wednesday with speeches about veterans issues, more than just this issue. Quickly, before we go, what else was on their policy agenda?
Well, they're also talking about things like long-term funding of the Iowa Veterans Cemetery, increasing the there's a military property tax exemption for veterans. They'd like to see that doubled. It's now $1,852 of the valuation of property. They'd like better mental health for veterans, expanding veterans treatment courts, a number of things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so last week we opened the legislative session. This week, you've been covering the legislature for a long time, as I mentioned at the outset, and state government. So what's the mood? Things getting down to business?
Absolutely. The first week of the legislative session, it's kind of pomp and color and ceremony. The governor comes in and gives a big condition of the state speech. The Chief Justice Mark Cady of the Iowa Supreme Court, he comes in and wearing his black robes gives a big speech. General Orr gave a big speech. This week, they really got down to business, and they really are rocking and rolling. There's dozens of committees meeting. They're grilling people like Jerry Foxhoven from head of Department of Human Services about some things that have come up in terms of Medicaid, foster care oversight. We've got a big debate already underway in regards to automated traffic cameras. Yet to come is legislation regarding state tax reform. This is going to be a full-blown session, and things are really fully underway right now.
Okay. Bill Petrosky of the Des Moines Register with, I'm guessing, no immediate vacation plans because he'll be quite busy at the Des Moines Register. Bill, always nice to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ben.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. Our program is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.